mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being here today. We got a great show, as always, in the interest of making sure you know what to watch, whether you're an originator, capital markets person, or just someone interested in the mortgage industry and some great market commentary. Here we are. We'll start out, as always, with a market update with the crew. We'll have Kevin with us today as well, but of course, we'll have James and Alex. And then from there, we will move on to a quick discussion about some underappreciated economic numbers. We were kind of talking on the side about some numbers we were seeing recently that we thought were interesting indicators that don't get a lot of press. So we thought we'd share those with you. Before we get into any of that in the way of data, OBMMI, the 30-year conventional 30-year fixed, is at 6.18. So seeing the spread between treasuries and mortgages continue to contract a little bit, which is a good thing to see. The 10-year, still around 4.25, still a bit stubbornly high there, but not breaking out. Not breaking out to the higher side, which is a very good sign. I think there was some worry. Certainly, we were worried about it, and other market watchers were worried at the beginning of the war that we'd be potentially seeing, you know, prolonged 6.5 rates with mortgages, maybe higher 6.75-7%. But there hasn't been a lot of buying in bonds, but there also hasn't been a ton of selling. So keeping our fingers crossed there. All right, let's go check in with the crew and see what's going on the market. All right, welcome. Welcome. We have a slightly oversized team here today to talk about what's going on in the war and the economy. We've got, as always, Alex and James. We've got Kevin with us as well. It's been a minute, Kevin. Welcome. Welcome, everybody.
Good to be here.
Morning.
Good morning. So where to start today? Obviously, we're kind of in Groundhog Day, at least I am, with this war. Is the strait open? Is the strait closed? Is the war over? Is there a ceasefire or not? It depends on who you ask.
We need like one website where we can just go and check this. Is the Strait of Hormuz open? Yes or no?
Who gets to populate it? It'll be like Wikipedia, right? Are people keep going on there and changing the answer depending on whether it's, you know, someone in a bunker in
Iran?
That's
a challenge for sure.
That's the headlines that are really dominating what's going on in the market right now, doesn't it seem? We were talking before I hit record just about how, I mean, I think we're somewhat lucky where we've been insulated from a lot of the violence of this war, at least in our part of the world, in you know, the West. Our military has been relatively safe, but there have been casualties. But it doesn't feel like the market. I think what you were saying, Kevin, is there's been some articles written recently that the market isn't pricing in risk, right? And the equity markets are a risk instrument. So, that, I mean, to clarify, I think they're not building in risk that the war could boil over or there could be hostages taken or there some risk that the war could go south on us, worse than it has already. So each day, whether it kind of talks are good, talks are bad, stock market is still is continuing to hit records, which that seems counterintuitive when we've got ourselves entrenched in a war that seems to be stretching out.
Yeah, you know, you would think so. I think a lot of folks, you know, might expect there to be more volatility or you know, disruption to the downside than what we've seen over the last couple months. And part of that, I think, where folks are more worried about is what happens to all the missing oil that is not, you know, entered or gone through the Strait of Hormuz over the last 2 months. Where does that end up showing up in the broader economy? And then, you know, the uncertainty from here forward of, you know, is this something that will just wrap up somehow in the next short period of time, whatever that is, or is this something that's going to drag on? Is it going to get worse before it gets better? You know, a lot of those things we don't really know, but a lot of market participants feel more confident or more optimistic about where those are going, particularly folks in the equity markets. I think the bond market has not recovered to where it was when the war started, with the 10-year treasury being below 4%. It's still been fairly consistently above 4.25%. You mentioned there was an interesting article that was published over the weekend by economist Kyla Scanlon. The article, it's in the New York Times. The title is something like "Why the Stock Market Doesn't Make Any Sense." And one of the major underlying theses is that markets are just simply not pricing in a level of risk that most analysts might find adequate, because of the idea of, you know, it's called the Trump put, or, you know, maybe less charitably referred to as the Trump taco. The argument with, you know, when you have the state responding in the way that it has to, you know, how the markets are doing, basically setting policy kind of within, you know, these set of throttles within the market. You know, you have your up and your down throttle. When the stock market goes up, that gives you more leverage to potentially, you know, make policy decisions that are more damaging to the economy. When the market goes down, the opposite happens, where you need to take more conservative policy stances relative to their market impact. And I think the challenge is, well, what happens with that is, you know, markets start to expect more from the state, and a lot of the risk that would naturally be occurring within the markets sort of gets offloaded to the state to manage. So then you find situations where, you know, the Strait of Hormuz is closed. There's, you know, 10 million plus barrels of oil missing every day. And, you know, you have the stock market at all-time highs. You know, some of those things might be counterintuitive. And some folks might just say, well, this is all, you know, it's not a big deal. These are small affairs, or they're all going to resolve themselves. And that's true. But that might be true. But I think the reality is, if these were easy things to solve, there's an argument to be made that, you know, that this could have been over already as well. So the lingering risk that we have within the market is, again, perceived to be not really a matter for market participants, but more a matter of the state to come in and resolve eventually. So that's kind of why we were, you know, one perspective at least on why we're seeing a lot of the, you know, uniqueness in the market that we've been seeing over the past couple of months. So I thought it was a very interesting article. I would encourage folks to go check it out. I feel like it helped me make more sense of what's going on, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we see it with a lot of things in the market now, and it does feel like we're complacent, maybe too complacent right now. And a lot of times, because not only have the last kind of 6 weeks of this war, I think, made people complacent because of the taco trade, right? Which means, by the way, Trump always chickens out. There's this thought that Trump won't let the war get out of hand, that the state won't let the war get out of hand. And if there are economic ramifications, those will be taken care of as well. And that complacency goes all the way back at least till the great financial crisis, certainly during COVID, where things got scary bad for like a day, and then the government jumps in and helps out, right? So that, I think, you know, to paraphrase, part of what you're saying is we're not pricing in the possibility that things could get out of hand, or Trump could allow a ceasefire to lapse, or could start bombing the infrastructure of Iran and really cause like a World War III. We're not letting that come into the trade. So we're seeing record highs, as if the war is not happening, or the war will end and it will be better off for it financially.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, you bring up a good point. The article also makes this point, which is, you know, this idea of the Trump put or the taco is not really a new phenomenon, but it's something that has become a bigger presence within the market over the last several decades. You know, we saw the same thing during COVID, where, you know, the federal government came in, and that was a more extreme scenario where, you know, we really didn't know what was going to happen, and the federal government stepped in to obviously smooth things over economically. We saw it during the 2008 financial crisis. We saw it during the 2010s with QE and you know, all the new unique things that the Fed was doing to try and spur economic growth. So, but it does seem like there has been this, you know, subtle but increasing to the point where it's now kind of in your face, federal intervention in the markets, helping put a floor on asset prices ultimately, which now the market has come to more expect or you know, rely upon. But you know, obviously there are times when there are limits to what the federal government can actually do. And so, you know, how is that risk being priced in? Is that risk being priced in? You know, I think those are things that that we don't have a great handle on at the moment.
Right. Well, what can we do but keep the blinders on and follow the money, I suppose. And then the money says that the Strait is less open today than it was on Friday, I would say, if you were to follow the money, follow the stock market, set risk aside. What else did we see last week, speaking of? Alex, I think you wrote a couple things down. Like, meanwhile, like the world still turns, economy's still moving. We had some numbers last week. We talked a little bit about inflation on the podcast last week. What did we get after the pod in the way of data?
Yeah. When we recorded last week, we were waiting on PPI, and it came in much the same as our CPI number did. Showed hot as we were expecting. And again, I think this is something that, you know, to go back to what Kevin's saying, you know, the market was expecting this, and it really shook it off immediately. PPI jumped for the non-core number, which is inclusive of energy prices, jumped 0.5% month over month, which landed it for the year around 4%. You know, these numbers, PPI was jumping here and there above 3%, but to see it jump to 4% is definitely indicative of the crisis we have going on the other side of the planet right now. And again, PPI is generally a leading number. Keep in mind, you know, these are input prices before that producers are seeing before you see that product on the shelves. So it could be indicative of some steep increases in CPI for the April release. We'll have to see on that. But that was the standout for me last week. It was relatively quiet on the data front otherwise.
Yeah. Good call. But like you said, numbers came in expectedly hot and we kind of shrugged it off.
Yeah.
Are we getting any decent data this week?
Yeah. We'll get a PCE to cap off all of our inflation metrics. And there will be an FOMC decision on, I believe, next week.
Yeah, I think it's the 30th is Fed meeting. So expectations, regardless of what happens with PCE this week, right? I would think flat rates don't move once again. The Fed is going to wait and see what the real effects are of the war, inflation, unemployment.
Correct. Yeah, sorry. It's PCE is next week along with FOMC meeting. This is a pretty quiet week.
Gotcha. All right. So I don't know. I have a couple of things on my mind, probably on listeners' minds as well. Maybe we start with James and go around the room. What's the biggest risk to interest rates right now, especially mortgages?
Outside of the war, I'll leave that to someone else. I think it's still on the discussion around Powell, right? So Powell it's coming up. His final official day is during the month of May, and he said, hey, I'm staying, right? I'm not stepping away anytime soon. Warsh has not been confirmed, and Tom Tillis is still holding up the Senate Banking Committee, and he is a lame duck. He's not running again, so he doesn't have to do anything that anyone wants him to. He can be as ineffective or effective as he wants, and he has until January, so he could hold this. The question is really, can the administration and Donald Trump just fire Powell, tell him to leave? You know, traditionally, this role, people previously they haven't had a following, they haven't had someone confirmed. So whoever is the head of the Fed stays on. We've never had a situation where the president says, well, no, you don't. So it becomes kind of an awkward situation where there's no rule saying who's in charge. You'd think the administration is, but the Fed tends to be independent. It's going to be a discussion. It's going to be in the news. It's going to cause discomfort with Fed independence, and that is a threat to rates. So I think that's going to be the biggest thing moving forward.
That's a big one. It's been the case for especially the last couple of years, the threat of the independence. But now you've got this unprecedented event of an expiring tenure along with Tillis dying on the hill of you know, I won't confirm anybody until criminal charges are dropped against Jerome Powell and others in the FOMC. I don't know. What do you think, Alex? I'll be setting that one aside. The war. Well, I mean, you could use the war. James passed on that. What's the biggest risk to interest rates right now?
I was going to jump as kind of a second order effect to the war, and tying back into Kevin's conversation from earlier. I'm going to say biggest threat, and maybe not as on the horizon as Powell and what James is talking about here, but I'm going to say finding the limits to that federal state intervention. It, as we said, you know, it got us out of the great financial crisis, you know, blunted the impacts there. COVID, you know, threw everything at the wall, massive programs. But these all came at a cost. You know, these conversations have been happening for decades. There's been, you know, going back to, you know, Rand Paul in the 80s has been talking about the federal deficit and the issues with it. But, you know, debt GDP for the U.S. now is approaching 140%. You know, the interest payments are massive. And I do think at a certain point, there comes to be a limit to what we can do to blunt the effects of a crisis. I don't know what that crisis could be. In fact, I don't probably think it'll be, you know, this war with Iran. But I do just want to call out the limits to that federal intervention and then a crisis that can spiral from there because we're not able to blunt the impacts of it.
Right, because we're finally broke. Yeah, I share yours. I worry about the debt. Our nation's debt, just the supply of debt that's out there and going to be out there between us and the rest of the world, including and especially NATO, with, you know, that budget looking to double itself by the order of trillions of dollars over the next decade, and then whatever we're doing over here, which we have not yet turned the corner of reducing.
Yeah. Yeah. So broadly speaking, I'd say it's the inflationary effects of the federal backstop.
Yeah. And what do we do if we actually have to step in again? How much ammo do we have, if any? How about you, Kevin? Biggest risk to interest rates. Toughest one is going last, I think.
Well, I was going to say, you guys are giving me the easy one. I'll take the effects of the war because I've something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and mostly just, you know, when you have an energy shock like what we've seen, and relatively speaking, I think like oil prices have not been. It hasn't been worst case scenario yet. You know, I think been flirting with $150 a barrel dated oil, which means like current spot price for buying oil in the physical market versus, you know, what we see if we go to CNBC or whatever is typically the futures, which can be different if you're actually trying to physically buy oil versus just trading, you know, the paper price. Given how quickly that spiked, and the impact in other areas, helium, petrochemicals, you know, it's not simply just oil, you know, fertilizer. There's a potential of the, you know, the effects of the war already to seep its way into the global economy over the coming months, you know, in a way that is net negative. And this is not to say necessarily that the sky is falling, but that, you know, over the course of 2026, you know, potentially into next year, you could continue to see prices of goods that the world economy highly relies on being higher than they were last year to a fairly substantial degree. There's already been reports of fertilizer prices being increased by about 40% for this year's growing season, which makes its way into food prices, you know, later in the year during harvest. Helium is necessary in everything related to chips, magnets,
medical equipment. It's
medical devices. Yeah, medical devices. That was what I was looking for there. Petrochemicals necessarily in plastics. So all of those things I think are items to watch for their inflationary pressures later this year, including food. There's, you know, some indications that the U.S., relatively speaking, could be somewhat more isolated from some of the worst effects compared to Asia, where, you know, they've had the steepest drop in actual physical oil. But I would definitely want to be keeping an eye on that. I feel like that's just something that, you know, was not really going to be a factor this year, and now, you know, you're going to need to keep a close eye on it to see how that might factor ultimately downstream into inflation, supply chain bottlenecks, a lot of the same things that we saw post COVID, you know, potentially not necessarily to that level, but yeah, I'm going to be keeping a close eye on those things for sure in the second half of the year.
All right. So they have the inflationary effects of the of policy and of the war. The two do overlap, but there's also there's a lot there. And you know, I'm not saying this is what's going on. It's certainly not the viewpoint of Optimal Blue, but some people think you fight wars over resources so that your country is less affected by these inflationary pressures that are building and probably going to build over the next decades, right? Wars make money. Again, follow the money.
One more anecdote on that. You know, there's some research. You talk about you know, food and inflation and, you know, natural resources. You know, anecdotally, when we had the, you know, the Arab Spring back in 2011, that was, you know, a situation where, you know, happened across a variety of countries. There was sort of civil, social unrest that unfolded all kind of around, you know, the same time, everywhere from Tunisia, you know, into Libya and Syria. What actually happened the year before that in 2010 was there were a series of major forest fires that happened in Russia in the area where you had, it's like the, you know, the breadbasket of Central Asia, a ton of wheat, lots of other crops that were severely impacted by, you know, this extreme heat and forest fires that were happening during that time. And there was some research that has actually connected those two activities where there were, you know, food shortages or, you know, inflationary pressures in those areas that are, you know, where a lot of that wheat and other crops come from Russia. So when you start to think about first order, second order, third order effects of these sort of global macro events, it becomes very unpredictable downstream. So that kind of ties into your point about, you know, resources and wanting to secure resources and using conflict as a means to do so, but just also kind of tying back to what I was saying, you know, I think there's a lot of things to watch for sure, you know, going into the second half of the year and then ultimately into next year, you know, downstream from the effects of this war.
Yeah. I think it will be very interesting that hopefully when this war concludes, see how that part of the world is put back together, right? That's going to be very different, I think. And what we have access to, what other nations have access to in the free flow of resources or the actual capturing of resources, I think it'll be interesting to try to follow that from this side of the world. All right, let's move on to the next segment. Pretty cautiously excited about this next kind of short segment we're throwing in here. We've got Kevin with us. So we were thinking about kind of, you know, some things that revolve around Kevin's world, not just at OB, but just some things he's interested in. So I thought we could ask him a couple questions on something that just came up in conversation last week, which was there's so many economic indicators out there. There's a handful that we all focus on very closely that the media covers, that things like unemployment rate and lately inflation numbers over the past, you know, 5-10 years, GDP to a medium extent. And then there's hundreds of others, but are there any sleepers out there? Like, are there some underappreciated economic indicators that maybe, you know, one could add to the widget on their phone or that they should be paying closer attention to just to really know what's going on either with the economy or to be able to have some view into what maybe economists and analysts are looking at when they look at investing or interest rates?
Yeah, so I'm a huge market econ nerd, and I love looking at charts. One of the more underappreciated apps, in my opinion, is actually an app distributed by the Atlanta Fed, and it's called Economy Now, and it has a number of metrics. Just, you know, recent metrics that I think all kind of tie back to the 10-year treasury yield. So, you know, things like unemployment, GDP, it has inflation metrics. But one in particular that I tend to frequently look at there is business inflation expectations. And I relied on this pretty heavily last year as a metric to help me understand how tariffs and their effects could be seeping its way into actual inflation data into the markets. So business inflation expectations, it's a 12-month outlook, and they survey around 600 or so business leaders each month and then publish those business leaders' expectations for inflation over the next 12 months. Now, inflation, we can calculate break-even inflation rates over the same 12-month period, so market implied inflation. But business inflation expectations might differ from that. Both data points, I think, are helpful because you have, you know, market participants who are out there trading, looking at what the market's expectation for inflation is going to be. But then you also have business leaders who are, you know, running their own business. They need to be thinking about things like payroll, the price of their goods, supply chains, things like that. And that's just a different perspective. So business inflation expectations pretty much throughout all last year stayed very steady. So there was not much of an impact of tariffs showing up in those business inflation expectations, which as time went on kind of had me feeling more confident that we weren't ultimately going to see a sustained rate of increase in prices, that, you know, the effects of tariffs might be more of kind of like a one-time thing. So that's something that I've gone back to pretty frequently. Also, you know, so far this year with the war happening, business inflation expectations still staying fairly low, right around 2%. So, you know, overall, I think that's good news given where we are, you know, so far at this point in the year. But that's definitely one of my top underappreciated market stats that I go and check frequently.
I like that one. I can't tell if it's just wishful thinking or if there's really this deeper understanding across the business world, the producer world, that tariffs somehow weren't going to do it. They weren't going to cause rampant inflation, which they ended up not doing, even though classic economists would tell you otherwise. And then now with the war, you know, should a war cause inflation, or is that more of a short-term tempered expectation? Yeah, expectations could be important, right? It's consumer sentiment, consumer, you know, tends to lead us to some assumptions about consumer spending, even though they're not usually right, at least lately. So something like this, yeah, makes a lot of sense that we would look to see what is sort of the mood within these businesses. Are they looking to, if they're expecting inflation, obviously they're going to raise prices, right? That's going to be part of their strategy, is to get ahead of that. So that's something, yep, I would want to know.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, inflation at the end of the day comes down to, it's not something that's centralized, it's something that's decentralized. It comes down to a million different decisions all across our economy around what is the price that we pay for goods or services, you know, versus what is the price that we feel that we need to raise the price of our employees, you know, salaries, you know, things like that. So, you know, it's also one of those things that when there is sort of a self-awareness of inflation, that also changes the dynamic as well. You know, when we think that we're entering an inflationary environment, that we also need to make different decisions as business leaders. So yeah, it's super interesting stat overall.
Sure. Yeah. All right. So that's a good one to start. Maybe one or two more. What else you got?
So another big one that I have been checking pretty frequently, it's a newer one for me. It's something I've talked about here before, and it's the churn unemployment, the current, it's like a nowcast of unemployment. And it's published by the Chicago Fed. So in the Chicago Fed, run by Austin Goolsbee, you know, also fairly active online, lots of commentary out there, but they created this real-time unemployment nowcast that looks at, you know, vectors of hiring and job attrition, and all the way down to like scanning Google searches, scanning, you know, employment postings, and putting together kind of a real-time composite metric for what the unemployment rate is. And it was released right as the government was shutting down, right at the end of Q3, right at the end of September last year. And it was a great thing to have when we weren't getting that updated BLS data for unemployment. And it's, you know, while especially since there have been shutdowns and there have been disruptions, you know, delays in getting data out, it's been a great opportunity just to be able to have a real-time view. And you can go and you can check it anytime. It, you know, gets updated on a weekly basis, and, you know, gives projections for where we think the next month's unemployment rate is going to land. So the good news there is the unemployment rate's been, you know, fairly stable. It was up to 4.5 and kind of back down to 4.3. So there hasn't been a significant deterioration in the labor market. That's also put a little bit of a floor on, you know, the 10-year treasury, because I think there was some concern around, you know, going into 2026, where were you going to see a softening, a labor market continuing to soften beyond 4.5% unemployment? Yeah, so far that hasn't been the case, but yeah, definitely another good one for me to keep an eye on, you know, in between months, and try and get a sense of where things might be trending for the next BLS report.
Good one. Yeah, you would think with AI now, there'd be more opportunities to take different inputs and try to kind of back into your own number for a lot of these prints, and not having to wait for things like surveys and things that could have a larger level of error in them. There's actually more tangible data that you could drive. I've got one that I'll throw in there. I got this one from Logan Modishami of Housing Wire, but it's residential construction jobs. So you reminded me of that just talking unemployment. It's one of those, another one where within businesses, there's a lot of kind of innate knowledge about which way the wind's blowing, right? And a lot of times construction, especially residential construction, may be one of the first things that's going to see, it's going to take the pain if there's a slowdown in spending, or rates go up, or there's a slowdown in GDP. So that number, I've been following it for the last couple of years now. And it took a bit of a beating last year in the summer, but then it's bounced back to almost as high as it's ever been. So it's, you know, feels like a pretty good indicator of the health of the job market, even with a little bit of noise around some of the current administration's policies on immigration. I think that caused definitely some noise in it last year. I think it's still a really good indicator of the jobs market.
Yeah. And that's, I love that one too. Residential construction actually peaked in 2006. So while, you know, we're still that. Kind of,
a lot of things peaked in 2006.
Yeah. Well, and while, you know, the stock market was, you know, continuing to go up, you know, that was like one of the first early, signals for, you know, the housing market to ultimately turn. So, yep, definitely agree with you on that one.
I definitely like, Kevin, that all your data points are those with skin in the game, you know, business leaders and, you know, looking at them for their inflation expectations rather than, you know, maybe calling the random consumer who maybe doesn't buy that basket of goods that we're looking at when it comes to inflation. You know, same for, you know, residential construction. These are people with skin in the game. These are people making hiring decisions. I think that's always a good delineator on what makes separates a good data point from a great data point. But with such a, you know, a dearth of information out there, Kevin, is there any that you just throw straight in the trash?
But basically whatever the S&P is doing during the war, you mean? No, just kidding. there are some. So I actually have a theory related to one economic data point where I just, you know, every year it comes around and I throw it right out the window. And that's Q1 GDP. And so here's my sort of like semi-conspiracy theory around Q1 GDP. So of course, GDP is an insanely important data point. Don't get me wrong. This is one of the most crucial, you know, opportunities for us to get a sense of what's going on in the economy. There's so much data that gets published, you know, alongside of it. But in Q1, we see sometimes the most volatility. If you look back over the past 15 years or so, Q1 GDP has most consistently underperformed the rest of the months in the calendar quarter. And the reason that I believe this happens is because when we're publishing Q1 GDP numbers, we do account for seasonality, but the big but is that we don't account for what the season was actually like or what the weather actually was during Q1. So Q1, obviously wintertime during, you know, North America. Sometimes we have very severe winters. In the Northeast, we had a fairly severe winter this year. Out West, it was bright and sunny and warm and, you know, lots of places, you know, really unaffected by winter weather. But when we do, when we calculate the, you know, our GDP numbers and we account for seasonality, we don't actually take into account what was the weather like. how might that have actually disrupted economic activity, or, you know, not obstructed economic activity? And so since that's not actually an input, what we have is really just like a smooth curve that's sort of averaged over the past several years. But if you have a winter that wasn't like one of the past several years, well, you know, this is why I think often we see an underperformance of our Q1 GDP number relative to the other quarters of the year. That's something that I've picked up. I'm pounding the table on that till the BLS hears me. And, you know, I can speak to their manager and, you know, ultimately get this situation corrected on good terms. So that's my metric that I'm going to typically throw right out the window every year.
Understandable. Maybe they need to start smoothing by which weather pattern we're experiencing that year. We have La Nina year.
Yeah. You know, plug right into, you got the National Weather Service right there. You could just plug right into their APIs, I'm sure, and start to better understand what's going on there. But you know, they haven't answered my phone calls so far. So
fair enough.
Okay. Well, there you have it. Kevin's underappreciated economic indicators, along with one that you can throw away. So we're going to need to move to some sort of trimester system, I suppose, because you throw away the first quarter every single year, and just focus on the other three. And then, yeah, some cool other things to kind of check out, including an app you can get that's hosted by the Atlanta Fed. All right. Thanks a lot, Kevin. Thanks, Alex. Great conversation.
Thanks, Kevin.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, let's wrap this thing up. Thank you so much, Alex, James, and of course, Kevin. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.